Hi, I'm Mary-Kate Fain, founder of 4W.
I'm Sasha White, and I am the co-founder of Plevity.org.
And this is Identity Crisis, a new show for gender-critical teens and 20-somethings.
Today, we're going to talk about logical fallacies. This is something that's come up a lot in the gender critical arena, as well as just in broader conversations online, because there is a lot of illogical argument happening. But we want to talk about this not just because we want you to be able to take down a bad argument on Twitter, but because understanding some basic logical fallacies can actually really help you with your own opinion forming and being sure that your own thought processes are based in sound reason and logic. So, Sasha, why don't you get us started by telling us what is a logical fallacy anyways?
Yeah, absolutely. So, a fallacy is, and I am now reading from Wikipedia, so take it with a grain of salt, but I think it's a pretty good definition. A fallacy is reasoning that is logically incorrect, undermines the logical validity of an argument, or is recognized as unsound. So now soundness, it says an argument is sound if it is both valid in form and its premises are true. So the premises meaning the statements from which the argument follows or is inferred. So in order to not be fallacious, an argument has to both have a valid form, so it has to proceed in a legitimate manner, and the premises have to be true. So we've assembled a little list of some of our favorite fallacies today that we think are very relevant to all the discussions that are going on and that we have on this podcast. So we want to go through a few fallacies with you guys and talk about them and why we think they're relevant.
And I think it's important to note that these are just a really small handful of the hundreds of different types of logical fallacies that exist. So if you want to learn more about fallacies, there's probably going to be a link in a description somewhere that you can click to learn more.
Yes, absolutely. Okay, so let's jump right into our fallacies. The first one that we have is equivocation. Using a term with more than one meaning in a statement without specifying which meaning is intended. So an example that we were talking about before is sex and gender. So why exactly is that, MK, an equivocation?
So this is something I think we see all the time, and I don't think it's always done intentionally, but the words sex and gender have become so conflated and used when you mean one or the other, and it's not clear which one you actually mean, that the words have actually become nearly synonymous in a lot of use cases. And I think that this has actually been why it has been so easy for gender identity ideology to take hold in English-speaking countries, because we literally think gender is the same as sex for most cases. So these words are actually different. Sex refers to biological reproductive ability, and gender refers to social roles inflicted on people based on their sex. And instead, what we see throughout society is even, you know, you're just filling out a form and it says gender, but then the options are male and female. So that's a clear confusion, because male and female refer to sex. Gender would be man or woman. But then, because this equivocation has already happened all throughout society, I think that that makes it easier in these arguments for trans activists who want us to equivocate sex with gender, to be able to say that they're, if you, like, basically, if they get you to say, oh, sure, you are a woman, the gender, then they're able to take that the next step and say, well, then, like, your sex is female, because sex and gender have become so conflated.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think what's important here is that when one term becomes muddled, or, you know, it muddies the water, it ruins the entire line of arguing. So, like, I interviewed Helen Joyce, who is trained in math, and she said that she comes at it with this perspective of, like, if one thing is wrong in the proof, the whole thing is wrong. And so that would be here, the definition of sex or gender, the definition of the word woman, for example, that would then muddy the entire argument that follows.
Yeah, maybe another word that I just thought of that's in this argument a lot that it's unclear what the meaning is the word radical. You know, we talk a lot about radical feminists, and the phrase used to, well, still does refer to, originally referred to the idea of getting at the root of something. And that's what a radical is, thinking of math as well. If you remember, then, you know, square root is radical. And so it meant getting to the root of women's oppression, which patriarchy and male violence. But radical in its common phrase means extreme and like on the fringes of society.
We're cool.
And yeah, we're cool. You're right. Yeah, radical. I'm a cool feminist.
Right.
But again, I think that this makes the argument more confusing because it's hard to say you are a radical feminist when people can interpret that as meaning you're an extremist.
So shall we move on to the next one?
Yeah.
Okay. Proof by assertion. Now, I'm sure this is going to be ringing a lot of bells for people listening. It's very familiar. A proposition is repeatedly restated regardless of contradiction. Very similar to argument from repetition, repeating an argument until nobody cares to discuss it anymore.
God, Sasha, can you think of something that happens in this argument like that?
Gosh, I really, you know, I've never seen that done. Like, where would that even
be? Like this one phrase that's just mindlessly repeated over and over again as if it's an argument.
Is it something about like women or trans or
maybe
something?
What trans women are? Oh wait, okay, I think I got it. Trans women are women.
Yeah, huh, you know, it's as rare as that one is, I think it fits.
I mean, this is just a classic example. The definition here says, again, it's repeatedly restated regardless of contradiction. And this, I think the way that this definition is phrased, I think could actually be interpreted two ways. I think it could be interpreted as regardless of someone contradicting it, like saying, for example, no, they're not women because they're males, or actually even regardless of a contradiction, even within the statement itself, which trans women are women. I mean, depending on how you define each of those terms, like, is not necessarily true. And so it's just this statement that is or is not necessarily true, depending on terms. So I guess that brings us back to equivocation, repeated ad nauseum on billboards and stickers, like as if it is the gospel, as if that's an argument.
Right. So the next fallacy is affirming the consequent being the second part of a statement. So if the statement is, if A, then B would be the consequent, right?
Yes.
So what happens in this fallacy is when you invalidly infer the converse of a statement. So do you want to give our example? So the logical example of A would be, if the statement is, if A, then B, you cannot turn around and say, if B, then A.
Okay, so would this be like saying, if all squares are rectangles, then all rectangles are squares?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, and so that's a fallacy because you're taking like a statement that is determined to be true, like if it's a square, that it's a rectangle, right. And then you're inversing it and assuming that the opposite must also be true. If it's a rectangle, it must be a square. If it is a square, then it is a rectangle. And so then if we were to do the fallacy affirming the consequent, then it's, if it is a rectangle, then it is a square.
Right. So our example for this in the gender wars is sometimes we hear, you know, people, gender critical people saying, so if trans women are women, then women are trans women. And it's like a gotcha. But another way that I think you can see why this doesn't make sense is to do a Venn diagram. So if you have let's accept their premise, which is false, right? Already that right. If trans women are women, that's a false premise. But if it was true, you would have a circle with women would be the big circle. And then inside it, you would have trans women again, that's false. So you can see then how you wouldn't be able to say women are trans women because they're a subcategory. But let's remember that trans women are a subcategory of males.
Yes. This is the problem with playing logic games, is sometimes in order to get to the point where you're debating that point, you have to accept the false premise. And so keep that in mind, everyone. We're going to play a lot of games today, I guess.
Yeah. And that's why we wanted to make sure to be clear in the beginning that we talked about how the for an argument to be sound, it has to both have a true premise and have a valid form.
Right.
So our next one is magical thinking, the fallacious attribution of causal relationships between actions and events. So MK, do you want to take it away?
Yeah. So in psychology, we normally think of this as believing that something that you're doing is like having an impact on something else, or that like you have the ability to do something or be something. So for example, if you think like, I am the Princess of Wales, and like you think that just because you think that, like you become the Princess of Wales and like people around you should start curtsying. Like, obviously that doesn't make sense. And we see magical thinking a lot associated with other mental disorders that maybe have some aspect of delusion and stuff along those lines. But it's also interesting though, because in anthropology, this is generally thought of as essentially just religion, like spiritual religion that assumes that if you pray or if you sacrifice, if you do this XYZ ritual, then it will have this result that does not actually, like there's no proof that that actually happens. It's purely like your belief that if I do this, then this other thing will happen.
Right. And then I think that it was Sasha Ayad who said that what you, your beliefs about yourself do shape your emotional reality. So, you know, while your beliefs may indeed shape how you experience your life, they don't shape the material and external reality.
Right.
So what are examples?
So here? In gender, where does this happen?
Yeah. So we see it happen with, I identify as a woman, therefore I am, right? You don't even have to shave that beard, you know? You don't have to do anything. You just feel like a woman. And often when you ask a genderist, what is a woman? They will say anyone who identifies as a woman, which is also circular. We decided not to do circular because we think everyone already kind of knows that one. But this would also be a form of magical thinking, of course.
Yeah. And I think to take it a step further, the idea, for example, that like non-binary, like there's a lot of magical thinking around like, yeah, I am not a woman and therefore I am different from all these other women in these different ways. And my life should be somehow materially different from other women because I think I'm different.
Right. And then also it's a sad bit of magical thinking that you believe you can identify out of sexism or an abusive a form of abuse that might come because you are female, and as we as feminists often point out, you can't identify out of that. You never have anyone asking a girl what they identify as before they subject them to something like female genital mutilation or other cruel practices that are only done on females.
And I think a lot of people who are doing that sort of, right, I think a lot of people who are doing this sort of magical thinking don't even realize that they're doing it. Like so many of the women we see, the young women identifying out of womanhood, it's really obvious that they're trying to escape some sort of like male violence, trauma, sexism, oppressive gender roles, homophobia, like these things that are related to their sex in their life. And if you ask them, will you still face male violence as a non-binary person? They would probably say, yeah, because I'm non-binary. I think there's even like, not only is there the magical thinking, but then there's like the total lack of self-awareness that that's happening. And so you're right. It's really sad, this one, honestly, because this, I think, is really just a lot of times people are just in pain and this is a coping mechanism more than anything.
Yeah. And then here's an example that's a little less sad, but sometimes men will identify as non-binary in order to distance themselves from being perceived as a threat. And then another example.
Or having that, privilege.
Yeah. Yes, precisely. Precisely. I think that's more actually than the being perceived as a threat. Although I think it can play out in the other way too, in the sense that they are then less threat. They come across as less threatening to women who buy into that form of magical thinking. So, because they're no longer a man or they're no longer a cis man. And then penis can be female was another example we had, because which is also the linguistic sleight of hand, as Zach Elliott points out, to cite him, that's from him. But because it's like, how can a penis be female? Well, if the person is identifying as a female, then everything about them is female. And that's what they say. And they say, like, MK, before we started filming, you said how some trans women wear t-shirts that says adult human female. And they're saying, yeah, I'm a woman because I'm an adult, I'm a human, and I'm a female because I identify as one. And therefore my body is a female body. My parts are female parts. And this is quite literally what people like Chase say and promote. So yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, our next fallacy is the Nirvana fallacy, which I think is also known as the perfect solution fallacy. So solutions to problems are rejected because they are not perfect. Do we have any non-gender?
We see a lot of that.
Yeah.
I can think of pretty much anything in politics. I mean, what's a first example? Okay, so right now we have this relief bill that's happening and people are getting their stimulus checks soon, hopefully. And so there's been so much critique of pretty much anything happening in that bill from both sides. But I mean, as when we see progressives saying, well, you know, this $1,400 isn't enough, it should have been $2,000, so let's not pass the bill at all. Or we wanted the minimum wage in it, so let's not pass the bill at all. And, you know, on broader issues, you can say climate change, like, well, okay, just having a carbon tax isn't a perfect solution, so let's not do it because it's not going to solve all of the problems. And I think pretty much anytime someone tries to improve society to some degree, they get this sort of pushback. Like, well, I mean, anything, like any social issue that you're trying to make an improvement on, people will make this argument.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was just listening to a debate the other night, which actually was really interesting because there aren't often a lot of debates between trans activists and gender critical people because we have one side going, no debate. But this was actually a really interesting, it was the first thing like this that I found that was on Hayden Hewitt's channel, Trigger Warning. And it was between Sarah Phillimore and a trans-identified male named Ashley Ruth, I think. And, but it was very civil and polite and respectful. And there were all these points of agreement being found. It was really, really great and refreshing. But one thing that the trans activist was arguing was, well, we can't actually enforce bathroom segregation. So why are we even talking about that? Why is that being brought up? And Sarah Phillimore conceded that we can't enforce it. But she said that she still thinks it's a problem because, it's still leading to a problem. Anyway, that's not the point here, but the point is that that's the Nirvana fallacy is like, well, why are we even talking about it? Because there's no perfect solution. It's going to happen anyway.
And that seems to be the case of pretty much all of the like women's space issues right now. I mean, sports being another one.
Yeah.
Well, there are some people who have disorders of sexual development who like maybe grow up their whole lives believing they're female. They have female anatomy from the outside. They have no idea what their chromosomes are. And so like, what about them? And it's also, I guess, kind of like the what about isms. I don't know if that might also be a separate one, but there's so many things where it's not perfect, but there are solutions that are better than other things. And when you ignore that, I think that's when it gets really problematic.
Yeah. And, you know, I do think that it can sometimes come from the gender critical side as well. Like people want the perfect pure solution. They don't want to give on anything. They don't want to give on like that. Maybe sometimes it is appropriate to, validate people's gender identity. It might be that is right in some cases, and I don't think we should throw out the baby with the bathwater necessarily. You know, you can, yeah. I'm not saying compromise is always the thing that has to happen, but often compromise is the way forward.
But I think, again, we see this a lot on policy issues. So if someone puts forward a bill that 99%, like it's going to help women in like a lot of ways, but it just doesn't go far enough that, you know, the radical feminists and like the very ideological feminists will support it, then like that is falling into this fallacy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But also not to be confused with rejecting something because it has a rotten core or, you know, the rotten foundation. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
The premise.
Yeah, exactly. So the next one is follows well from that one, but the slippery slope fallacy. So asserting that a proposed relatively small first action will inevitably lead to a chain of related events resulting in a significant and negative event and therefore should not be permitted. So yeah, again, we see this on both sides at times.
Yeah, I think, you know, obviously on the trans activist side, we see a lot of things along the lines of, well, if you say that trans women aren't literally women, then all of these Black trans sex workers are going to be killed. And it's like that has nothing to do with the actual issue at hand. And we see this all the time. If you deny kids puberty blockers, they will kill themselves. And it's not even just people like on Twitter or whatever who are making these arguments. There have been headlines that say things like a life and death decision when speaking about giving off-label puberty blockers to children. And it's really disingenuous. Maybe they genuinely believe that that's what's going to happen, but that is a slippery slope that they just can't prove.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, any kind of criticism of gender ideology is often responded to in that way, that it goes straight to the most extreme, significant negative end result that was not what was being proposed or not even a result of what was being proposed. But we did note that sometimes it can happen on our side too. So for example, like if you're going to take a hardline stance, like I think pronouns are Rohypnol and I'm never going to use preferred pronouns because it obfuscates, because it will then lead to, you know, women having their rights violated. Now, maybe there is validity to that, but let's be careful to not fall into that slippery slope of like using the preferred pronoun is going to lead to XYZ.
Right. And same with if we give an inch, they'll take a mile. Mm. Well, maybe they will, but you have to prove that they're going to take that. You can't just say that they are going to do that. And I think that this applies to the other side too. You know, maybe what they're saying will happen, but again, you have to actually lay out those steps. How do you get from A to Z? You can't just say A and then boom, Z. There are, you know, 24 other steps in between there.
Yeah. And maybe that's a good time to say what you had pointed out earlier, which was that a fallacy, because an argument is fallacious, does not mean that it is necessarily false or true, obviously.
Or that the conclusion. Yes.
Yeah, thank you. Right. Because the premise is false, right, of a fallacy. But don't mistake it for saying like, oh, that's fallacious. The conclusion is completely off, because you could use fallacious reasoning to then say something that's true. So red herring fallacies are a subcategory of fallacy, and it was hard to choose just a few because so many of them are familiar to us that we are up against. So a red herring fallacy is an error in logic where a proposition is misleading or intended to be misleading in order to make irrelevant or false inferences. So kind of like just throwing something in that doesn't have to do with it. I mean, I think I remember red herring is sort of a detective thing where it's a false clue. Like you think that's going to lead you to the real criminal, but it doesn't. So a red herring is something that misleads or distracts from a relevant or important question.
Yeah. And again, we see this all the time. Pretty much any argument that you're having, when someone doesn't have a good argument, they're back up against a wall, they'll try to change the subject. If you have ever been in a relationship or had children or had a fight with your friend, you have probably either been on the receiving or giving end of these. Most of us have been both at some point in our lives. So for example, if you're fighting with your partner and they say, you know, you never do the dishes, I wish you'd do the dishes more. And then you say, well, your mom was awful to me at Christmas. Like, okay, maybe true. Like, yeah, maybe that did happen. But like, unless there's some connection between that and the dishes tonight, that has nothing to do with it. It's a total distraction. And I think that we do see this in a gender debate all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, and it similarly can be simultaneously, it can be an appeal to emotion. So like one example from the gender ideology side is like anything you say, they're going to go, well, Black trans women are being killed, which is also the appeal to emotion. And it's also thought terminating because it's so horrific. It's not like I can say, well, no, like to that, but it's not responding to what the person was actually saying. And then it can be done on our side too. I mean, if you don't know what to say, you can just go like, well, 137 women are killed every day. Or I think the number is something close to that, which is a super important thing to talk about, but can be used to draw attention away from the original topic sometimes.
Yeah. I just real quick looked up where the phrase red herring comes from. And I think that knowing this is interesting. So apparently it comes from how hounds used to be trained to follow scent by smoking herrings, the animal. And when they're smoked, they turn red. And so then the hounds were trained to follow that scent and as like a distraction, essentially from a different scent. And so I think that, you know, if you think of it that way, a lot of times these arguments are used to send someone down a path. And it works all the time. We get caught up in it. If you watched our episode on how to have an effective debate, I think we saw a lot of that. Someone will throw out a red herring and you take the bait. You're the hound running, chasing after that smoked herring smell. Exactly. But you know, you don't have to do that. You don't have to take the bait.
Right, because it literally gets you off the scent, right? Well, if you're a dog, literally, if you're us, it's not literal.
I think when someone throws out a red herring, you should see that as a sign you're actually going down the right path, and you should totally ignore their red herring and like just continue down the path that you're on, because obviously they don't have an answer for that.
Excellent point. And if you ever need to manipulate someone, just use a red herring.
Yes, always.
So, because like you said, it's a sign that they're on the right track. I love that point.
Yeah.
So our next and last fallacy is Kafka trapping. So a sophistical, and we're going to get into that word, and unfalsifiable form of argument that attempts to overcome an opponent by inducing a sense of guilt and using the opponent's denial of guilt as further evidence of their guilt. So I'll read you guys a quote from Kafka's The Trial. "But I'm not guilty," said Kay. "There's been a mistake. How is it even possible for someone to be guilty? We're all human beings here, one like the other." "That is true," said the priest, "but that is how the guilty speak." So you can see how this plays out.
So it sounds like this is named after this specific book where this person is trying to prove that they're not guilty, but in proving that they're not guilty, they're proving to the person that they are guilty.
Right. And, you know, it did just occur to me that sometimes when you overly deny your guilt, it's like the lady doth protest too much. You do make yourself look guiltier, but we have to remember that that doesn't actually prove your guilt. It's just a psychological effect where the person will look guiltier. But sometimes it's done out of nerves or whatever. It might mean that maybe they're guilty, but maybe they're not. So it would be a fallacy to think that that means they are guilty.
I listen to a lot of true crime podcasts, and we see this all the time and in both directions. When someone does something that is like, well, that's what a guilty person would do in trying to prove their innocence. And maybe it's what an innocent person would do who's trying to prove their innocence.
Right.
And they're just like not thinking it all the way through that it could make them look guilty. And you really don't know.
Okay, so, and then this was described as a sophistical attempt to overcome the opponent. So we just wanted to briefly touch on sophistry, which is an interesting topic. So the sophists were paid teachers of philosophy and rhetoric in ancient Greece. So as opposed to Socrates, who just went out to the town square, basically he just logged onto Twitter. He's like, come at me, like ask, you know, whatever. And then he would just ask them questions. We all know the Socratic method. Which by the way, we like the Socratic method, don't we? Because we think that's more effective.
Yes. So, actually, going into that episode, I did a little bit of research on the Socratic method, and it's a lot more than just asking questions. And there's a lot more specifics in there. So maybe sometime we should actually dig a little bit more into the Socratic method.
Let's do that. I would love that. That would be super fun. So for now, all we'll say is the sophists were... they're associated with skepticism and using clever rhetoric that isn't true or that it's fallacious. And this is kind of how lawyers get such a bad name, because they're considered to be sophists who just use their rhetorical skills for money and to win, but not in search of the truth. So the Socratic method, I believe, is in search of the truth, and sophistry is not. They don't care about the truth, or they'll purposely obscure the truth in order to win or to just get paid. Like they were a paid teachers so that they were more like cynical and skeptical about, we'll teach you how to win an argument.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
That reminds me of these like professional wokes who write books convincing people that they are guilty of things, and that if they claim to not be guilty, then that is only further proof of their guilt, this exact fallacy. Like, for example, white fragility.
Right, exactly.
By Robert DiAngelo. Yeah, which, yeah. I mean, it's the whole thing.
It's the whole thing is, I think Ibram X. Kendi had just tweeted, the heartbeat of white supremacy is often denial. So that right there, that's the Kafka trap, because if you deny that you are racist, you're even more of a racist.
Yes.
And remember, so it doesn't, denying that you're racist doesn't mean you are a racist or you're not a racist.
Right. It's just a statement, like, about what you think about yourself or what you want people to think about you. But it's true. And I think we see this broader, like, in the whole, like, critical theory space in general around privilege. And if you think that you don't have privilege for whatever class of people you belong to, then that's only further proof of how much privilege you do have. So, you know, if you're wealthy and you think that you don't have any privilege, aka you say you're not guilty, I don't have privilege, then your denial of your privilege is only more proof of it. And I mean, maybe, but just because they say they're not. And what's especially crazy is that you can have two equally situated people and one person admits their guilt, aka privilege, and one person does not admit their guilt. And the person, no matter what, like, they're exactly similarly situated besides what they say about themselves. But the person who is not admitting their guilt is seen as more guilty.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's like one of the powerful cores of, you know, a certain genre of literature, which The Trial is of. So that brings us back to, you know, Kafka, The Trial, because he, it takes more bravery to do what you said, right? For the person to keep denying their guilt. It's the cowardly thing to give in to what they want you to say. And I can't make a statement on this completely, but it probably won't help you in the end. I mean, I didn't finish the trial, so I don't know what happened in the end. But it's this situation where it feels like just give in and then you'll be safe. You'll be able to protect yourself. Right. But you are giving up
a
lot.
But then you're under their control. Maybe you're safe from what the immediate consequence was. Mm. Like, admit you're racist or else we're going to cancel you. Yeah. And so, you know, these people might bend over backwards to say, yes, I'm full of white privilege and I have racism that is internal and I'm still trying to learn and whatever. And however much of that is true or not, doesn't matter. Yeah. But now they've said it. So they're like, okay, I'm safe. Like, I said the thing I was supposed to say. But then, like, now you have this group of people who control you. Like, you are just a puppet and they're your puppet masters. And now everything you do, now that you have shown that you will capitulate, that you'll bend over backwards and admit your guilt over something that you may or may not really believe. And then they, like, you know that you cannot back out of there because you're under their control now. They have this over you.
Right, exactly. You can't take it back if you've admitted guilt. And in the trial, he didn't know what he was being accused of. Like, no one would tell him, which added to the obviously nightmarish vibe of it. But make sure you know what you're admitting to. If you're gonna say I have white privilege, like, make sure you know what that means. Can you define that? Can you quantify that? Can you give examples and evidence of that?
Yeah. And this is not, I mean, again, like, we're talking premises and stuff here, but, like, this is not to say, like, whether or not I even agree or disagree with the concept of white privilege. It's just that idea that denying it makes you all the more guilty. Like, That is a logical fallacy.
Precisely. Yeah. So I think we can start to wrap up, right? We've reached the end of our list.
Yeah.
Let us know if you guys want to hear us do more discussion on formal logic like this, if you would be interested in a discussion about the Socratic method and maybe contrasting it to sophistry.
If you've noticed that you tend to use some of these logical fallacies and learning about them has changed the way that you think, we'd also be really interested to hear that. I think that at least for myself, once I became aware of these, I started to catch myself using them in different ways in my language, you know, even just day to day with my friends and family that I'm debating with. So let us know if learning about any of these changes the way that you express your own arguments or even changes an opinion that you thought was logical before. I'd be very curious to hear.
Yeah, we want to know that. And if any of these resonated with you, or if you recognized them and you were like, yeah, I just saw someone using that. Or maybe like MK said, you realized that you used it. And then I did want to add also that while we generally, I think, take a very charitable view of the other side, we try to really talk about logic and argumentation and accuracy, but a lot of what's being used against us is bullying and harassment, and you know, that's not something where you should try to wade through and keep arguing or pointing to their fallacies. It was just 2 days ago that from when we filmed this, that Billboard Chris, I don't know if you know of him, MK, he got beat up by trans activists on the street. So he's this guy who wears a sandwich board.
Oh, I know.
So, yeah, so children cannot consent to puberty blockers. And he was attacked by trans activists. So you can see men coming at him in the video, and they broke his arm. And they were screaming, you know, get out of here with your transphobia or whatever. So it was very clear who did that. And we saw a couple weeks ago in Paris what happened with throwing an egg in Marguerite Stern's face and the other stuff that they did. So I just wanted to throw that in there. Like we are up against people who aren't trying to give such a charitable interpretation of what we're saying. And even though their arguments are riddled with fallacies, it's sometimes more glaring that they're just using bullying tactics.
I agree with that completely. I think that getting wrapped up in these arguments, that these endless arguments, trying to point out their fallacies is even sometimes a way to just distract you from actually doing the work, to keep you busy, to get you to say something that they can then like pin you for. And so I don't necessarily think that we want to learn these just to engage in these fights online or in real life in spaces that are a waste of our time or putting us at risk. But I think instead, this is for like being able to look critically at something. And I think a lot of people who watch the show have probably come to similar conclusions as us on gender identity already. But there might be other issues out there where you're still trying to figure out what you think about it. And when you see arguments on those things, hopefully you can look at them through the same logical, critical lens that we use to look at gender identity.
Great point. I think I'm going to try to do that from learning about these. You know, I had a good time looking them up, and they do interestingly start to apply and you start to see them. So it's a great way to sort of clean out your own thoughts and ways of thinking. So thank you guys for tuning in, and we are back with new episodes every Monday.